Welcome to Be Customer Led, where we'll explore how leading experts in customer and employee experience are navigating organizations through their own journey to be customer led and the actions and behaviors employees and businesses exhibit to get there. And now, your host, Bill Stakos.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another week of Be Customer Led. I've got a really interesting guest for you guys this week. Mark Brackett is founding director for the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence, and he's also professor for at the Child Study Center, Yale School of Medicine. Really excited. This is a really important topic, as you all know, and I get a lot of questions around EI. Mark, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Mark, I ask each one of our guests to just kind of go through their journey. You've got this incredible career in academia. What drove you to focus on emotional intelligence? You can go back as far as you like, if it's part of the story. So,
yeah, I think it starts in the womb. I just actually wrote a book on this and it's called Permission to Feel, because as a kid, I didn't feel like I had the permission to be my true, full feeling self.
Right.
I had abuse in my childhood. I was bullied as a kid. And so I was trapped with these feelings. And of course, when you're trapped with your feelings, you're denying them, you're suppressing them, you're eating them, you're yelling them, you're tantruming them. But to cut this long story short, I was blessed in life to have an uncle who was a miracle. He was a band leader at night and a middle school social studies teacher by day, who happened to be thinking critically about the role of emotions in education. He was writing a curriculum back in the 1970s.
Wow.
I was his guinea pig. And it was a blessing, because he was the first adult when I was a kid that really understood me. He was the first adult who really asked me that simple yet profound question, which is, how are you feeling?
Yeah.
Anyway, to cut this longer story shorter, things got a little better for me in high school, college. After college, I'm like, what am I doing with my life? And I had this epiphany that what I was doing was I was going to pull my uncle out of retirement, and we were going to write a curriculum together to teach middle schoolers how to deal with their feelings. And that set me on the journey to get my PhD in psychology, studying under the founders of the theory of emotional intelligence, which then led me to realize that it had nothing to do with kids. It's all the adults who are messing kids up.
And so, as a parent, I take offense to that a little bit, but I know what you mean. No, absolutely.
Yep. You got to be that role model. They're not learning these skills. They're learning them by, the implicit and explicit things that are happening. And so anyhow, I have spent the last 25 years trying to be an emotion scientist, running around the world, trying to get people to talk more about their feelings and learn the strategies on how to regulate them effectively.
I love the power of that simple question, how are you feeling? Right? As leaders, we don't ask that very much. Maybe COVID drove some of that, I feel like, more. But generally speaking, I've never had a lot of bosses that have asked me, how am I feeling? How are you doing? What are you working on?
Well, think about it, Bill, in just one thing.
Yeah, go for it.
Ask me how I'm feeling, if you don't mind.
How are you feeling?
Fine.
What does that mean exactly?
Exactly. See, there's nothing to go. Now ask me again, Bill.
Mark, how are you feeling?
God, Bill, it's like this odd mixture of despair, frustration, and anxiety.
That's a tough mix, Mark. Let's talk about that. Let's talk through that.
Yeah, like how many bosses are going to say that's a tough mix? Let's go out for coffee and spend the next 3 hours unpacking those feelings.
Very few. Very few.
But how many people have felt that way during the last year?
Oh, I mean, it's got to be over 90% of the country, of the world for that matter. I want to get back to the question and the power of that question, but can you tell us a little bit about just emotions in people and how you view emotions playing a part in our lives? I mean, it may seem like an obvious question, but forgive me, but I'm not sure a lot of people think about that.
Because a lot of people think emotions get in the way of life, right? That's the historical view. Emotions are idiosyncratic impulses that drive you to make bad decisions in life.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's why that was the geniusness of inventing this concept of emotional intelligence, you know, because Peter and Jack, who are my mentors, they said, well, maybe the emotion system is a smart one. And, you know, my research is focused on five areas of why emotions matter. The first is attention.
Mm-hmm.
Emotions drive where you pay attention. Think about that. When you are bored, right, your brain goes somewhere else. Like,
yep.
If people are bored with this podcast, right, they're going to
hopefully not. Yeah, absolutely.
We're going to keep them engaged, right? Which is an emotional process, right?
Yep.
We're going to try to elicit curiosity and get people excited about these things, because then they're going to listen and learn, or at least pay attention. When you're stressed out, overwhelmed, and scared, like I was as a kid, you're not thinking about learning. You're thinking about survival. And that's just the way the brain operates.
Yeah.
Intense, strong emotions put you in fight, flight, freeze mode, not learning mode. When you learn how to manage those feelings effectively, then you can go back into that learning mode. The second is decision making. You know, so many of us, especially people who are highly successful, right, they think, you know, it's my IQ that got me to where
I'm at.
It's my IQ. And the truth is, yes, IQ matters. But our emotions are underneath every decision we make. They're there. They're just not necessarily, you're not conscious of them.
Mm-hmm.
By way of example, I've done studies where we randomly assign people to be in different mood states. Just think about a good day, think about a bad day, and write about it. Sort of the subconscious, like priming to get you in a good or bad place emotionally. And then we have you make judgments and decisions. Within milliseconds, we get people to think their best friend is never going to be their best friend. We get people to think the stock market is going to crash. We get people to think that they're not going to have enough money for their retirement. Teachers in my studies make evaluate their students differently.
Mm-hmm.
But the antidote to that is self-awareness, right? When you're really aware, oh, yeah, I am in a bad mood. Oh, maybe I shouldn't allow that to interfere with my judgment. The third is relationships. We have a saying in our center that emotions are signals to approach or avoid.
Hmm.
Think about that. You ever work with someone who is really difficult?
Sure, of course. Who hasn't? Everyone.
Yeah, people who, like,
you work long enough.
You have to watch every word that comes out of your mouth because, like, it's just like everything is sensitive, or they make weird fate. Like, they disagree in meetings and they roll their eyes.
Yeah. And some of that's self-imposed on some level too, right? Maybe you just have an asker that really not like that, but you think that they are as well, right?
You don't know necessarily, but you know, when someone's rolling their eyes in a meeting, it's not the greatest thing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when you think about those people, do you say to yourself, gosh, I want to work with them for the rest of my life? Or do you say, I got to go to the bathroom, or I'm going to call in sick today, or I'm going to go down that hallway because I see them coming.
Sunday scaries, as they say. Yeah.
The fourth is physical and mental health. That, you know, how we feel, right, varies in intensity.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Sadness can lead to despair. Being peeved can lead to being enraged. And if we don't learn to identify those little feelings, oftentimes they become big feelings that can interfere with our mental health. We've shown in research, for example, that the climate of a company or organization leads to teachers. In my studies, I do a lot of work with educators. So like a negative climate in a school stresses out teachers more, makes them feel more negative emotions themselves,
mm-hmm.
and then impacts sleeping, their sleep, their physical health, their body mass index, which is their body fat.
Yep.
So we know that the feelings of our workplaces affect our individual feelings, which affect our health. And then finally, the big one for a lot of people is performance and creativity, customer service.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I'm in the real world a lot because I do a lot of travel and presenting. I check into a lot of hotels, and it's amazing to me, you know, how, like, your room's not ready. Okay. Thank you. Maybe I'll check into another hotel. Or I'm definitely not coming back here.
Yeah.
Or you go to a restaurant. You know, I'm a coffee shop fanatic. It's like, it's 50% the quality of the coffee, but 50% whether or not I like the barista.
Sure.
You know, and so I think companies who don't take seriously the emotional intelligence of their employees are making huge mistakes, because not only does it affect like the company performance, but it affects also individual performance.
Of course.
You know, as a professor of students who are, you know, very cognitively, you know, skilled, because Yale is a place of, you know, kids who have the best mm-hmm. grades and the best mm-hmm. test scores, you would assume that everyone's going to be successful. But why is that not the case? It's because emotions play a big part in our success. You can't manage the anxiety, can't deal with the frustration, can't deal with the harsh feedback. Mm-hmm. Guess what? Oftentimes you give up.
I've got to buy your book pretty badly.
I can't believe you haven't.
No, please do not be insulted. But I will absolutely. And I want to talk about a little bit before we close out the show, of course.
No worries.
Doing this for 25 years, what has maybe surprised you the most about emotional intelligence, whether it's in adults or even children for that matter?
How little we know about it.
Even still.
People, because you know what happened is when a concept gets popularized, you know, people think of emotional intelligence as charisma, you know? it's not charisma, that's personality.
Sure.
Emotional intelligence is a set of emotion skills that help you to identify emotions in yourself and other, understand their causes and consequences, label them with the precise words, and then knowing the nuance of how to express them, and having a real kind of pocket full of strategies to manage all the different emotions that we have. And, you know, I always make the parallel. My other career for many, many years was I was a martial arts instructor. And so I have a fifth degree black belt in a martial art called Hapkido, and Korean martial art, and spent many years of my life kind of understanding and learning the martial arts. Yellow belt, blue belt, red belt, yep. black belt, first degree, blah, blah, blah. Like, you had to learn how to block, you got to learn how to do the right
sure.
fancy punches and poke people's eyes out. And, you know, you get so much feedback. You know, like, you got to do these moves in order to get the promotion. Where do we have that in our nation, in our world, for emotional? We just don't. And so there's no criterion of success, and therefore we don't really know what to do about it. And part of my hope in part of why I wrote this book was to give people the criteria. Like, what does it mean to be skilled at recognizing emotion? Now you have kind of a baseline, and now here's how you grow. Give you an example. So and if you don't mind, I'm going to put you through this test.
Go for it. I love it. I love interactive when my guests turn the table.
Okay. What's the psychological difference among anxiety, fear, and stress?
I do not know the answer to that, Mark. I mean, I know I've felt all those three before, and I can probably describe the situations. I guess for me, at least, fear is more around... And this is, again, sample one here. Fear is more about the unknown. Anxiety is about the known. And stress is around the here and now. But fear and anxiety for me are a little bit more future state, whether it's the next day or the next year or the next 10 years. Stress is the here and now, right? Preparing for the show, you know, et cetera. When I'm in the moment. Anxiety is about, and fear is about the unknown. But, fear is about the unknown for me. But anxiety is, I know it's coming. And that could be stressful in and of itself, but that's how I kind of think about that.
What do you think? Pretty clear?
No, not at all. But that's how I, you know, that's how I squared it in my simple brain, Mark.
I'm just kidding with you.
I'm just a customer experience guy. You know, I don't, you know, this is, you know, I think about this stuff a lot, actually. I'm just joking. But that's how I would describe it.
But this is like, you know, like you, how many, like you had, you didn't have emotion vocabulary 101 in college.
No, you're 100% correct.
And so, like, anxiety is about uncertainty, right? The reason why you get anxious is because of the unknown, actually,
yeah.
right? Like, oh my God, it's COVID. What's going to happen? Stock market, my health, vaccines. Unknown causes you to be anxious. Fear is really about impending danger, right? I'm actually going to be, you know, get hurt. There's danger ahead of me. Stress is when you have too many demands and not enough resources.
Yeah.
And so they're different.
They are.
Overwhelmed is another one, right? Overcome by emotion. And so some people may say, oh, this is just like, you know, the ivory tower trying to look smart. But the truth is that you got to name it to tame it, right? And if you don't really know how you're feeling, then everybody goes to these one-stop kind of ways of regulating. Oh, just do some breathing exercises. Well, guess what? If you're afraid of something, you know, you're not going to breathe it away.
That never works, actually. But name it to tame it, meaning you're like, this thing makes me anxious. That thing I'm fearful of. That thing creates stress for me. Is that how you mean?
Like, yeah. So, for example, you know, in professor world, the way you get promoted, right, is you get tenure.
Sure.
And so many years ago when I was going up to be a full professor, you know, I said I was stressed out. I had heartburn. I was getting headaches. I was freaking out. Go to the doctor's office. What does he say? Here's your Prilosec for your heartburn. Here's your Ativan for your anxiety. I'm like, really? That's your solution? So anyhow, I was annoyed by that. I left his office and I took a walk and I'm like, Mark, you're the director of the Center for Freaking Emotional Intelligence. Like, what's going on for you? And so I'm like, are you anxious? Okay, let's think about that. Not really. I mean, I've got a pretty good CV and yeah. Got the grants. Okay, I'm not stressed. I'm not anxious. Stressed. Too many demands, not enough resources. You know, I put a lot of hours in, but I don't feel that like I'm not exhausted. Okay. Are you afraid? Fearful? No. Are you overwhelmed? Oh, shit. That's the one.
Yep. Yeah.
And the reason why I realized that was that I had no freedom. Like, I just felt like I was getting up in the morning at 6. I was working out. And then I would eat breakfast. And I'd go to work from 8 o'clock. And I'd come home at 6. And I'd go to yoga. And then I would have dinner, do more emails. And I just said, I mean, at like 11 o'clock at night, I'm like,
yeah.
Doing emails.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I would say, I'm stressed. And it wasn't that I was stressed. It was that I didn't give myself any freedom. And it was, I had that aha moment that it was like actually not like going to another yoga class. It was like skipping yoga that day and like going home and doing nothing for a little while. Mm. Or just like shutting my computer after dinner and saying like, enough is enough. And so that's when I say you got to name it to tame it. What that saying really is getting at is that you have to label your feelings accurately to know what the best strategy is to manage it effectively.
Yeah. Do you think that emotional intelligence gets, because I think like the word emotion sometimes has negative connotations in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Do you think that emotional intelligence, sometimes people don't maybe give it its credit and due because of the word emotion in it?
I think that word emotion, the word feeling, you know, it's, maybe it stems from old terms like, you know, emotional, which means out of control, hysterical.
Yeah. Right? You're being so emotional, right? Like, how many times have you heard that or seen that in a movie or whatever it is? There's never a great connotation.
Yeah.
Right?
And my response to that is, no, you're gaslighting me right now.
let's switch gears a bit.
Sure.
I want to talk about, outside of the individual, I'm really curious about the topic, and I've tried to think about this, but I mean, you know, when I've got my 5 minutes, because I'm overwhelmed, can you have collective EI is EI scalable? Can you have a collective EI for a company? And how does that manifest? Okay.
Well, firstly, I think that it's not useful to only think about developing the individual.
Yeah, sure. I get that.
In my childhood level, I'm just going to go there for a second to just give give an example. So here I was, victim of bullying. Parents, you know, my father was like this tough guy. He's like, son, toughen up. My mother was having nervous breakdowns every day. Lovely people, but like not emotionally skilled.
Were we brothers at some point? I just...
And then, you know, I'm in school being bullied, and then I'm going, my parents got me a therapist, which was actually great. But let's think about it. I got 1 hour a week playing ping pong with the play therapist, and I got like 10 hours a day at home with my neurotic mother and angry father, and 6 hours a day in school being bullied.
Hmm.
So there's something wrong with that picture.
Yeah, right? Very little balance there, yeah.
And do you think that applies to the workplace?
Similarly, sure.
It's the same thing, right?
Yeah.
So like if I'm struggling as an employee, but the leadership team doesn't believe that emotional intelligence matters, the C-suite is like, this is, my favorite example of the company I can't mention because it's confidential,
sure.
But big, big financial company, New York City. I do a talk for the, 300 or so investors, and go to meet with the senior people in a small room, and the head honcho looks at me and he goes, interesting talk, not for me, but interesting. And I said, tell me more. He's like, well, look at my office. You think I need this training? And I said, I'm curious, what else? He goes, well, some of the things you said are pretty good. Maybe I'll bring you in to train the people who work for me so that way they can deal with me better. And I was like, whoa,
Off camera, can you please tell me the company? So I never go work there ever. Holy cow. It's incredible that you get, I'm sure you have worse stories too, but
we have all those stories. And so my point about that is that me, Mark, working for this company, going for my emotional intelligence training, yes, of course it may help me with some certain things, but if my colleagues aren't playing by the emotionally intelligent guidelines and my bosses aren't doing that, the workplace is still not going to be a pleasant place for people to work.
How have you seen performance in your work change? When you've got that behavior, it changes over time, right? It's not a flip the switch and it happens. But in the work that you do, what kind of performance differences do you see? I mean, there must be output, efficacy at the individual and team level. I'm sure revenues, profitability of companies improve, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm. So we did a national study a couple of years ago where we looked at 15,000 people across the workforce, and we looked at the emotional intelligence of their supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
And the question was, did people who work for people who were higher versus lower in emotional intelligence have better outcomes at work? So the one thing, you remember, emotions matter, they drive our attention.
Yeah.
We found a 40 to 50% difference in daily inspiration in people who work for people who were higher in emotional intelligence. We found about a 40 to 50% lesser amount of frustration at work.
Hmm.
We found that there were significant differences in burnout, engagement, turnover, and tensions. Think about the money that we spend in an organization with turnover.
Huge sums, yeah.
We found ethical behavior was different in organizations where there was a leader with higher emotional intelligence. And so the list goes on in terms of the benefits of working for people with these skills.
And do you think the training, I don't mean to put you on a spot here, but I can't tell you how many EI courses I've personally been through. It's a topic that I do care about, and I try and invest time in. Not perfect by any standard, but I'm curious, do you think the training that companies are putting their employees through, are you seeing that make a difference and have an impact?
I have. I have the benefit of having started my own company with a bunch of colleagues 3 years ago to focus on emotional intelligence in the workplace. It's called OG Life Lab, OJI Life Lab. And we took everything we learned from the science and practice of emotional intelligence and built a system that we know really works well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, a workshop can be inspiring, right? But what I think people need in developing these skills is A, time to develop the skills.
Mm-hmm.
So we built this technology which provides people with 50 sessions of training on emotional intelligence.
Wow.
Going through all the mindsets and the skills and with practice sessions. And then we add coaching into it so that you can actually get feedback and learn and ask questions from your coach. And we've seen remarkable results. And what's interesting to me is that our company consults with big companies. We've got clients like Google and Amazon. Mm-hmm. And then we work with companies like Kohler,
who make
sinks,
toilet
bowls. And then even, trucking companies and, Masons. And it's been really cool to listen to what every stakeholder shares in terms of the value of the emotional intelligence training. And I think what's most valuable for people is building the language skills, like having the vocabulary and really knowing that. The way I like to think about it, Bill, is that like it's a human right to be self-aware.
Sure it is, yeah.
You know, and so many of us, like as a professor of emotional intelligence, right, I can tell you, you know, what all these constructs mean. You know, I know the difference between an emotion and a feeling and a mood. And, you know, most people wouldn't know that, and that's fine.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You can get through life without knowing that stuff. If you're an engineer, you've got better language than I do for lots of things. But again, like I said earlier, so few of us have had an emotion education. And so we're going through life, oftentimes in a cloud, clumping our feelings into good or bad, and not knowing what to do with those feelings. And so what I wanted to do, and what my colleagues and I did, was build these modules to really get people to be granular and specific and understand their feelings, and then learn the strategies. You know, it's funny, emotion regulation, the top of the hierarchy, right? It's like, what do you do with that stress, anxiety, frustration, overwhelm? How do you motivate people? How do you get people to feel inspired? How do you get people to feel calm? So emotion regulation is both myself, but it's also working with other people. And I just never even heard of the concept until I was in graduate school. And then all of a sudden there's like a whole theory of emotion regulation. There's all these like categories of strategies, like breathing exercises, like mindfulness exercises, like changing your self-talk. You know, I find so many people have automatic go-to self-criticism strategies. Do you have any of those?
So I don't know if I've got something personally wrong with me, Mark, but I do not self-criticize, and I never have. And I blame my Greek mother for that.
Okay, cool. And you're very lucky.
It's very strange. I think my brother is the same way. I've never ever...
No.
Don't get me wrong. I've definitely done wrong things in my life, but I don't criticize myself for it. And I never, even since a kid, I've always looked at it as, I made a mistake and I'm sorry for that. And this is how I move on and correct it. But I never, I never look back on that as a, oh my gosh.
What about like, I mean, you're a Greek god, obviously. So
No. Not
just kidding. But no self-criticism in terms of like self-esteem issues ever?
No, never. And I'm probably like...
We definitely didn't have the same parents, by the way.
I'm sure there's levels of narcissism in there that is a reason why. Yeah, you know. I've never been self-critical. I don't know why that is.
Like been mean or cruel to somebody?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Oh yeah.
At least you're somewhat.
Yeah. Cruel. No. I'm not. Yeah. I'm not without fouls. You know, without
or ruminate.
Issues.
You ever ruminate?
No. I don't.
Wow.
I don't.
Gosh, I'm feeling envious of you.
No. That's not. No, I feel like sometimes I'm like. I'm not normal because of it, because it is normal to ruminate on things, right? And like, could have done that. You know, what happens here? What happens there? Like, that's a normal thing.
Do you experience a lot of emotion?
I'm in the chair now. That's what. not necessarily. No. Whatever, you know, in the back here part of my brain, right? It just, I don't get a lot of triggers that way.
Interesting.
So, yeah.
All right, we'll do it. We'll do a post session.
I'd love it. I'd love it. I'm sure now he's got his hands together, folks. For those who are not going to see the video, he's like, oh, another.
Exactly. I got some work.
I'm sure I've got hours and hours of work that I need to do and talk out. But I just, don't ruminate on stuff. I never look back. I've never just looked
back.
I get angry. Sure. Yeah. That's, you know.
So what's your go-to strategy when you're really pissed?
Well, like you growing up, the natural reaction to from my dad was to take that out on us physically. So I do make it a very, very pointed about this. Like I don't want, like I'll never get aggressive. When I'm super angry, I do breathe. I do think about what, you know, ask myself, what if I'm wrong here? Or what if the situation is wrong and I'm reading it wrong? I try and just take a step back and just reflect on that in the moment as quickly as I can, so it doesn't escalate.
Great. So you just shared a number of critical strategies, right? So you take deep breaths to deactivate.
Yep.
And you do what we might call reappraisal or reframing. You know, trying to say, is there another way to look at this? Is there another lens? Is there a different perspective? Those are all really critical strategies that most of us haven't learned. You know, I, on the other hand, given my childhood, you know, I was very chubby as a kid. I was made fun of for that. I'm Jewish, and there was one point of my development where my nose was bigger than my entire body. And, you know, so I was made fun of for that. And so your nose is too big, your nose is too short, you're too fat, you're too this. And there was no intervention, right? So what happens? You rehearse that.
Yeah.
It becomes your default.
Yeah.
And so for many of us, like myself, it's taken years to kind of reprogram. Say, wait a minute, like, that's not helpful. Or like, when the pandemic hit, you know, my center closed. We all had to work from home. The stock market was crumbling. People were dying and getting sick. And I'm just sitting in my room working. And I am, I'm thinking like, oh my God, what's going to happen? I have to work till I'm 150. You know, with, you know, people are And in those moments of catastrophizing, which is another default strategy that I was blessed to learn from my parents, it's like, whoa, there's got to be another, you know, that's when that reappraisal is so important.
Yeah. Yeah.
That stuff that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Then this, by the way, you know, exercise, nutrition, sleep, all affect our regulation.
Sure.
Social support and connection. Is there anybody in your life that when you're around them, like you just feel more at ease?
Sure. Yeah. My, my three kids, my wife, my brother, or his family, my mom. My dad's no longer around. Never was really at ease with my dad, but my mom. Sure, there are plenty of people in my life, thankfully.
And so that's co-regulation, which is a big part of our talking about workplaces, right? We always think of like everyone's got to be self-controlled. It's not the case.
Yeah.
There is what's called emotional contagion in our workplaces. So a stressed out leader creates a stressed out organization. And what's interesting about that is that, you know, someone who's like catastrophizing or really worried or stressful at work, it kind of goes into the ethos.
Yeah.
People start absorbing it.
Yeah.
And they're feeling it, but they actually don't even know why they're feeling it. That's this nuance of contagion. Yeah. And so my argument for workplaces is that we cannot underestimate the power of co-regulation, that the way we speak, our vocal tone, our body language, our facial expressions all create feeling and affect the feelings of others. And that dynamic reciprocal nature of emotion can affect productivity, creativity, everything.
One of my last questions, I want to talk about the book a little bit too before we go. When you think about artificial intelligence coming into the mix, so now you're dealing with a chatbot. You're not looking across from someone and, you know, seeing their facial expressions, inflection in their tone, you know, stuff like that. How is that impacting our ability to maybe even sort of work that muscle? Is it going to make us get worse at it? Like, I'm curious if you've studied that at all, or I'm sure you have looked at it actually, given the work that you guys do. But is that impacting us negatively? And I mean, if we're dealing with technology so much, does it impact our ability to deal with each other after in a negative way, or does it have like negative impact? Here's the example. I am constantly using my phone technology, when I'm interacting with businesses or companies that I buy products and services from, it's mostly through digital channels. Those feel like they're becoming more and more ubiquitous out there. I'm talking to my TV or talking into the remote, etc. Is that impacting our ability to connect with each other and maybe pick up on those signals even differently.
Definitely. You know, think about it. Like if you're looking at your phone all day and on social media all day, you're not looking at people's facial expressions very much. We also know that it affects our mood states, you know, that the more time you spend scrolling through these sites, you know, oftentimes the worse you feel afterwards. We think we're going to feel better, but then we feel worse. I think we have a crisis of connection in our society. And we know that. We know from research that people who are chronically lonely, people who are isolated, live significantly fewer years than people who are in positive relations and socially connected. And so my belief is that we need to figure out ways to help people engage in more face-to-face, whether it be on technology or in person, preferably in person, because the same neurochemicals don't get released when you're on technology.
All right, let's hear a little bit about the book. And again, apologies for not reading it before we chatted, but I will. I know it is actually, admittedly. Tell me, like...
And now you should be, you should be engaging those negatives. I can't believe this.
Now I'm going to be ruminating on
it. Now you're just going to rationalize
it. What's wrong with me? Why do not I have emotion? What was the genesis of the book? Why did you write it? And, you know, what kind of tools could our readers expect if they buy it?
Yeah. So the book is called Permission to Feel. And it's basically an overview around the power of emotions to achieve success in life. And the what I think is important is that A, we give ourselves that permission to feel, right? That ability to be our true, full feeling selves, which includes being self-compassionate, non-judgmental about our feelings, that we recognize that there's no such thing as a bad emotion, right? All emotions are helpful. And even anger is helpful, right? It tells us there's an injustice. Anxiety is helpful. There is uncertainty. Let's problem solve about it. Let's be, you know, proactive about it. And then to teach people the science, because I think so many people don't take emotional intelligence seriously because they don't understand the science. And then finally, what are the skills? Like, how do you develop the underlying skills? So I call them the ruler skills. Recognizing our own and others' emotions, understanding the causes and consequences, labeling them, expressing them, and regulating them. And these skills all work together, right, to help us, as I say, use our emotions wisely to achieve greater well-being, to build better relationships, to make sound decisions, and to, you know, at the biggest level, help us achieve our dreams in life.
Cool. I love that.
And so that's what I hope people will get out of it.
So, all right, one last question. It's out in Greek. I am fluent. I am fluent,
Greek,
actually, but I'm going to prefer it will take me three times as long to read it in Greek. One last question. You talked about inspiration before and mentioned it. Where do you get your inspiration from?
You know, it's funny. Right now, my inspiration comes from doing nothing because I've been a doer for so many years, and I just moved to the country. Right now I get the opportunity to look out my window at a beautiful pond with trees, and it just helps me to be more reflective. I'm so used to being in an environment where it's like competition and go, go, go. And now I'm sort of like, my inspiration comes from.
That sounds like a nice
freedom.
It's a nice end to this conversation, actually. Mark, thanks so much for coming on the show. I really do appreciate it. Amazing, so many amazing takeaways. And I am buying your book on Amazon the minute we hang up here. I suggest to all readers actually go check this out. Mark's a really interesting guy and clearly a leader in this space. So, Mark, have a wonderful weekend. Thanks for the gift of your time.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. All right, everybody. Great week. Great guests.
Thank you so much.
We're out. Talk to you soon,
Thanks
everyone.
Thanks for listening to Be Customer Led with Bill Stakos. We are grateful to our audience for the gift of their time. Be sure to visit us at BeCustomerLed.com for more episodes. Leave us feedback on how we're doing or tell us what you want to hear more about. Until next time, we're out.